You're clearly seeing signs that the consumer is spent up and lent up. We got the consumer confidence numbers last week, and they surprised everyone being weaker. Expectations were particularly weak. And within that, and importantly, I think, and you and I have talked at length about this, Adam, the labor assessment deteriorated dramatically.
Wow.
And so what you're seeing is consumers are clearly drawing down their saving, running up credit card balances, as we know already, to support just the basic lifestyle.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. It feels like a tale of two economies right now. If you ask an economist, chances are you'll hear that the U.S. is doing great, growing faster than its G7 peers with low unemployment and a stock market back near all-time highs. But if you ask the average man on the street, you'll likely hear a very different story. One of hardship, where wages aren't keeping up with the massive spike in cost of living, where companies are reducing hours, freezing hiring, or actively laying workers off, and households are increasingly forced to turn to expensive credit cards to fund living essentials. Which of these is more accurate? And are things likely to get better or worse from here? For an expert view, we're lucky today to talk with Stephanie Pomboy, economic and market analyst and proprietor of macromavens.com. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Adam. Always great to be with you.
Always great to be with you. And we actually got to spend time together in the flesh a few months ago when I briefly zoomed into where you live for another event there. And I got to say, getting to spend time with you and Wilhelmina in person was just such a joy. And I hope she does grace the camera today at some point.
Well, she's still talking about it. She's like, "Where's Adam? Come
Well,
back and visit again."
she is such a love. And I was surprised to learn how young she was. I mean, she's still very much a puppy. What a great, such a cute dog.
Thank you.
Anyways, lots of questions here for you, Steph. Lots to talk about. If we can, let's just kick it off with my usual starter. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, I guess my assessment, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, is pretty much the same as the last time you and I huddled together here. And that is that I am convinced still that the fastest interest rate hikes in our economic history are going to have real consequence on the economy and the financial sector. And we are seeing that play out, but so far it's been sort of poo-pooed or generally dismissed as temporary and problems that will be resolved as soon as the Fed cuts rates. Never mind that seems to be getting pushed farther and farther out into the future. So I continue to believe that we are going to see a real slowdown in economic activity, and we will see problems around servicing debt at these substantially higher interest rates, both on the part of consumers and corporations. Meanwhile, all the consternation around debt service seems to be singularly focused on the federal government, which I think is the one group that you really don't need to worry about because they have access to a printing press in the form of the Federal Reserve and the power of taxation. That does not apply to consumers and corporations. So they're kind of flying without a safety net, unlike the government. So I continue to be focused on debt service issues in the consumer and corporate space, and the knock-on consequences for the creditors who have extended that credit to them. A broad slowing in economic activity. So, I mean, boy, it all sounds pretty gloomy. And unfortunately, that is sort of my central thesis, is that we're going to have a substantial slowdown, and we're seeing signs of that emerging already.
Okay, as longtime viewers of this know, I am very much on team lag effect. That's what I hear you saying here, which is we're gonna feel a lag effect from these high rates, and the longer they stay higher, which is kind of Powell's latest guidance here, the more entrenched that lag effect should be when it arrives. Now that being said, I can understand emotionally, at least, the viewer that says, "Hey, come on, guys. You kept talking about the shoe that's going to drop forever, and it hasn't yet." And I know you said you're seeing some of the signs, so we're going to talk about those in just a second. And one of them you might point to is, well, I mean, GDP growth for Q1 was only 1.6%. I mean, that's a marked slowdown, right? But I just looked at GDP now. They just upgraded it today for Q2 to 4.2%. Now, GDP now bounces all around, and let's see where it ends. But certainly 4.2%, if it were to come in at that, would be pretty serious growth for the second quarter. We'll get into the details here, but at a high level, what would you say to the person that says, "All right,
Right.
Stephanie, GDP growth looking like it's going to be 4.2%, unemployment still below 4%, stocks near all-time highs. Like, what's the reason to worry?"
Yeah. Well, several things. Within that first Q GDP report, if I can go back to that, most of the growth of that 1.6% increase that we saw in growth, 1.2 percentage points or so, was related to consumer spending on housing, healthcare, and insurance. So that is not a sign of strength, in my view. This isn't consumers running out and taking vacations and buying second homes and a new car or anything like that. Quite the contrary, they're spending every dollar they have and then some just to keep up with the basic necessities. To give you some specific numbers, total real consumer spending in the first quarter was up $97 billion for the first quarter in real terms. $74 billion of that was non-discretionary stuff, like I just outlined, housing, healthcare, and insurance. Real incomes in the same quarter were up $44 billion. So you had incomes of $44 billion, spending of $97 billion.
Wow.
And so what you're seeing is consumers are clearly drawing down their saving, running up credit card balances, as we know already, to support just the basic lifestyle. Again, they're not running out to take elaborate vacations. And another sign that's maybe more timely that I would point to, and I think is really important and hasn't received hardly any attention that I can see in the financial sphere, is restaurant activity. And we heard for a long time while consumer spending on goods was slowing, that we didn't need to worry about the slowdown in goods consumption because what was happening was consumers were now shifting their consumption from goods to services. You know, they loaded up on all the doodads and whatever they wanted during COVID when they had to sit at home. And now they were prioritizing spending on services like experiences, including particularly eating out and restaurants. In January of this year, the National Restaurant Association has a monthly performance index that they report. And in January, that index hit its lowest level since restaurants were shuttered for business during COVID. So I made note of that because it was shockingly weak and thought, well, maybe it's that people spent so much money on their Christmas presents or whatever that they're now just in January hunkering down. And we'll see that rebound. Well, in February, the index posted, if it went like this to the lowest level since COVID, it barely picked up off the mat. And then in March, rolled back over again. So there's something going on here, and it's a sea change in the consumer spending. This is probably one of the easiest and simplest discretionary spending windows is what's happening on the restaurant front. So I'm continuing to focus on that, but you're clearly seeing signs that the consumer is spent up and lent up. We got the consumer confidence numbers last week, and they surprised everyone being weaker. Expectations were particularly weak. And within that, and importantly, I think, and you and I have talked at length about this, Adam, the labor assessment deteriorated dramatically. So we did get a bad payroll employment report on Friday, or at least weaker than expected. And that was news to Wall Street that we were finally seeing some slowdown in job growth. But consumers have been downgrading their assessment of the labor market for a while. So that's critical because the argument for what's been sustaining consumption has been this tight labor market. And there's a lot we could say about the tight labor market, which again seems like a real misnomer because what's happening is you've seen a collapse in full-time job creation. Full-time jobs are actually down year on year. They're declining 1.5% year on year, while part-time jobs are exploding. And this is why you have this huge increase in multiple job holders, because I think what happened is companies had so much trouble hiring people back after COVID that when they finally were able to get to a full staff, and then business started to slow, they said, well, we're not going to lay people off like that. We'll just cut their hours because it was so hard to get Bob and Susan and whatever. So we're not going to let them go. We'll just pare back their hours. And they chipped and chipped and chipped and chipped away at hours to the point that Bob and Susan had to go out and take out second jobs. So you now see this increase in, part-time versus full-time jobs and the multiple job holders at a record, all while, as I mentioned earlier, the real income growth is still lagging behind basic non-discretionary outlays. So I could not push back hard enough on this notion that the consumer is strong. People look at these headline like retail sales numbers and say, look, they're spending, but you've got to take out the inflation in retail sales. And what you find is that when you take out inflation, real unit sales have gone nowhere for over 2 years now. And then you have to look at how they're funding this expenditure, and it's by drawing down saving and running up credit card debt. So these are unsustainable dynamics. And the reason why it's critical, of course, is that the consumer is the engine of the economy, is also the engine of corporate profits. And that kind of has the knock-on consequence. Consumers are now struggling. It's going to blow back to corporations because they are now trying to service debt that's double what it was a year ago. They're able to do that because profit growth has been robust. But as that profit growth withers, they're not going to have the wherewithal to continue servicing rapidly inflating debt. So I think we've got, a lot of forces coming together here in, to use that perfect storm analogy. And ironically, they are all kind of hitting precisely as Wall Street has persuaded itself that the no landing thesis is the right thesis. Everything's fine. In fact, the economy is so good that the Fed may not be able to cut rates anytime soon. But it's fine because where we won't get low rates, we'll have strong growth and strong earnings. So suffice to say, I my view is not consensus.
All right. That was a great run through. A few things just to mention that corroborate a lot of your statements. I talked about this the other day with Lance Roberts. I pulled up some charts of corporate profits, both absolute corporate profits and corporate profit margins. And what's really interesting is they're doing just fine. And so the question that I talked with Lance about was like, did basically corporate America just push the entire cost of the inflation that's been generated post-COVID onto the consumer? And it's kind of hard not to make that argument, right? And that only works for a certain amount of time, right? Until you kind of kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And what you're saying is consumers are getting more and more pinched, that they're now at the point where they're having to cut back, and that actually will start impacting corporate revenues and then thus corporate profits.
And you're hearing that from companies. You heard obviously two high profile ones last week, Starbucks and McDonald's, both noting that their consumers are starting to say, hey, we can't absorb these higher prices anymore. But you're right. I mean, all of it went to margins because they just passed everything along. One thing I would say, though, in that profit number, this is again another really important distinction that I don't think people make, and that is everyone's very aware of the gap between the haves and the have-nots in the consumer sphere and the idea that the top 1% is doing great and the bottom is really struggling. Very few appreciate the degree to which the skew is every bit as wide, every bit as profound in the corporate space. Those S&P earnings numbers, if you go through and look at the share of the earnings contribution made by the top 10 companies. I mean, basically, we're talking about in the corporate sector a handful of companies that are driving all of the price performance, but also all of the earnings growth, and the rest aren't doing very well at all. So I got these numbers from S&P. Sorry to go off on this whole thing, Adam, but
It's a great point. Keep going.
the top in the last quarter, the top 10 companies alone accounted for over one third of total S&P earnings. The top 100 companies were 75%. So you have 100 companies in the United States that are basically generating all of the profit growth. The bottom 100 companies are losing money, and that's of the largest 500 companies in the country. If you broaden the lens to include the thousands of small and mid-sized businesses that don't make the cut for the top 500, the situation is much worse. And I can give you some stats on that because I look at that nerdy government accounting of corporate profits that comes out with the GDP report. And it shows over the last 2 years, one quarter the increase in profits that the S&P numbers reflect. So again, it's a story about the haves, the very few companies that are doing well. They have cash, they can service their debts, they are driving price performance, and they have earnings. And everybody else is sort of like your average Joe Sixpack consumer who's just struggling to sustain their enterprises.
So I talk about this a fair amount, but you're doing a great job of emphasizing its importance, which is this is really a story of mean versus the median, right? Where if you look at the averages, things look pretty good. If you look at average consumer household balances, if you look at average corporate, profit margins or debt balances or whatever, it doesn't, the average doesn't signal trouble. But it's because you have these colossally, massively affluent individuals or massively profitable companies that are huge, at the very tail end, and they're pulling everything up. They're pulling an average way up. So if you look at where the median is, which is the 50th percentile in each, it's in real danger territory. And to your point, like it's really, you get your top couple of percent, and it's really everybody below the top couple of percent is in danger territory, right? But the average person, certainly the average reporter, doesn't think of it that way.
And the average actually doesn't really reflect anybody anymore. I mean, you're either at the top or you're at the bottom. The average is sort of a useless number in that regard. I mean, how many companies are making average earnings growth? I could go through those S&P numbers, but I would guess very few of the
Very few.
500.
Yeah.
But to your point, this is why I come back to drawing these distinctions, because we look at these averages and people, for example, they dismiss this concern I have about the corporate credit issues as they try to service debt at higher rates and point to all the cash on corporate balance sheets. Well, the top 10 companies in the S&P 500 hold more cash than the bottom 400. I mean, it's just the skew on the balance sheet thing is even more profound than the earnings. So you have 10 companies with all the cash, and everyone else is like sifting the sofa cushions for, any spare change. So the wherewithal, the capacity of companies to handle any increase in debt service is far lower than people appreciate, which is why we've had the highest corporate bankruptcies since the global financial crisis. So these things are happening. This is why I'm frustrated is, it's not that the higher rates haven't hit. They have, but they haven't hit the top companies in the S&P 500 that people focus on, but they will. We're seeing the small and mid-sized companies are the ones that are really struggling, and it's eventually going to feed up the chain. If I'm right about the outlook for earnings, which will greatly, diminish the capacity to service debt at these higher rates, even by higher quality companies.
So let me ask you this then. So again, going back to the average and the median, when you talk about the top, the top 10 companies having more cash than the bottom 490, right? And we're just talking about the S&P 500 in that case, right? employees are much more equally distributed, right? So in other words, the top 10 companies don't have almost all the employees, right? So when we have the bottom 90 plus percent, suffering, they're going to have to start laying off workers. So that's where I think the rubber may really meet the road in the story, is as that bottom 90% gets to the point where it's been keeping Sue and Bob along for as long as it could. It cut their hours as much as it could, but it now says, "Sorry, guys, I've been holding off, forever, but I got to let you go." That is when consumer spending could really get compromised, and of course, then that could translate into that vicious loop of lower consumer spending, more layoffs, et cetera. How worried are you about that?
Absolutely. Actually, you and I, this will be a flashback from like a year ago. I remember we talked about that idea of going from labor hoarding to labor shedding, where companies, they hung on, they hung on, they hung on, and hoped that eventually the recovery would come, and then finally decide, we just can't hold on any longer, and they do have to just start chopping heads. So I agree with you 100% on that score, and maybe we're starting to see that a little bit. As reflected in, as I mentioned earlier, that weaker payroll report, but also the consumer confidence. The consumers are the ones who really are aware of what's happening with their own job security, and as they look for jobs or have friends who are out there looking. So their assessment has really been downgraded. Also, last week we got the ISM surveys for both services and manufacturing. And what was interesting is that the employment component for both of them declined, but the services one really declined sharply, which was, again, comports with what I talked about with the restaurant, traffic and sales data, which suggests consumers are pulling back, and the service sector is going to broadly start to slow, which is kind of the last shoe to drop in a way here. So that drop in the ISM employment for services was a pretty sharp and significant move. So we'll see. We could be, at a turning point on that score.
Okay, and a few more things just to add on to points you've been making. One is you talked about, in addition to the fall off in restaurant sales, we're seeing other consumer spending companies like Starbucks and McDonald's say, "Hey, we're seeing a slowdown too." We also saw it in Tyson Foods, and they specifically called out that it was consumers cutting back on their spending. And I think Tyson Foods a little bit different because, that's just America's protein, right? This is people going to the grocery store. You're going to cut your eating out bill first, but you still have to put food on the table. And it's basically saying that enough households are having to cut back on their purchases of, chicken and beef and stuff like that, that it's really beginning to impact Tyson. So I just talked to your good friend David Rosenberg. I interviewed him earlier this week. He had a couple really interesting things to say. One, totally agrees with your point that consumers are highly levered, continuing to have to put more lifestyle expenses on the credit card. A lot of key stats he mentioned, but one that stuck in my mind was that delinquency rates on credit cards are now back to 2011 highs. So 2011, you're getting dangerously close to how bad things were during the Great Financial Crisis, right? He also talked about your skepticism of the quote unquote tight labor market, and talked a lot about that with varying guests on this channel, that it doesn't seem to be as solid as the Fed seems to keep telling us. David said, "Look, the Fed's making a big mistake because it is looking at it's looking at data that is not only lagging, but seems to be flawed." And one of the key data points he looked at in the labor market was he went back and did his analysis looking at the, and forgive me, let me just make sure I get it right, the QCEW, the quarterly census of
All right.
employment and wages, which, unlike the BLS surveys, which just talked to a relatively small number of households, this has 12 million inputs. So it's much more data driven. And he said that by his math, it is that the current payroll numbers that get put out are overstated by 800,000 to a million.
Yeah, I thought 1 million was the number on that
Yeah.
overstatement.
Yeah, and that's a big chunk. You know, that's a real material number. So he basically said, look, those numbers, the revisions are going to come. They might not come for a couple more months, but when they do, he said, look, the Fed was you know, initially scrambling to raise rates. It's going to be once it realizes how much weaker the labor market is than it thinks, and it's kept rates this high, it is going to be scrambling to cut rates at some point soon, or some point, you know, as soon as it realizes the mistake. And obviously, if you look at history, almost every one of the past recessions we've had basically was preceded by the Fed hiking rates aggressively, plateauing, and then realizing, oops, we went too high, we've held it here for too long. The recession starts, and it just starts scrambling, cutting through the recession. So his prediction there is really nothing more than just the cycle repeating.
Status quo, lather, rinse, repeat, as they say. I mean, this is the
Yeah.
Fed's MO. But yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, one of the things that contributes to this overstatement of employment is the birth death plug factor. I think that's really the thing that gets implicated in leading to either underestimates as we're starting to recover or overestimates as the economy is starting to slow, because the birth death plug factor, for those who aren't nerds like me, is basically an imputation that the BLS adds to every monthly payroll report to try to guesstimate how many jobs were created by new businesses that haven't yet, you know, set up payrolls or, you know, gone through that whole, that aren't yet captured in their whole payroll processing, you know, methodology. So the way they estimate that is they take last year's business creation and use that number. So they'll say, oh, in February 2023, new businesses created 120,000 new jobs. And then they'll shade it, you know, slightly up or down, but basically it'll be 100, you know, plus or minus 1,000 jobs that they just magically add to the payroll number. So what happens is at turning points in the economy, they're imputing, let's say right now, they're imputing job creation that isn't taking place, and that's inflating the payroll numbers. And then eventually, a year later, when they get the actual data, they go back and revise it and say, oh, our bad. You know, turns out those jobs were never created. So that's why you get these yawning gaps between what the payroll numbers are reporting and what is actually going on at the turning points. It's exactly when you need the data to be accurate, is when it's least reliable at these major turning points.
So you and I love analogies. To me, you know, everyone's always classically, and I think correctly, largely said the Fed, you know, the way the Fed sets policy is like driving by looking in the rearview mirror. This is like looking in the rearview mirror that's shattered, right? So it's just giving you all sorts of, you know, obfuscated or erroneous, data that's also lagging, right?
I always have referred to them as monetary magoos because I'm old enough to remember Mr. Magoo from the cartoons, who would like stumble into these construction sites and he was so myopic he couldn't see anything that was going on in front of him or around him. And, you know, it always was a catastrophe. So that's sort of the Fed. I mean, they just can't see the nose in front of their face.
All right. Well, look, on that theme, I'd like to get your reaction here to yesterday's recent comments by Stanley Druckenmiller. You know, highly respected investing mind. He had some choice words. I'm going to read through them as quickly as I can, and then I'll let you respond to them. Basically, they misdiagnosed COVID and thought the economy was going into a depression. The Treasury is still acting like we're in a depression. They've spent and spent and spent, and my new fear now is that spending and the resulting interest rates on the debt that's been created are going to crowd out some of the innovation that otherwise would have taken place. Everybody seems to get it, but Yellen, who just keeps spending and spending. I think it's dumb politically because it's causing inflation, and it doesn't take a genius to figure out that the average American is getting hurt by the inflation. Quick comment. I have a little bit more to read, but anyways, let me take a pause for a second. Quick comments on that?
No, I totally agree with it, but it's hard not to imagine this is all political. You know, if there weren't an election in November, I don't know if we'd necessarily see these policies. I mean, maybe. But I can't disagree with anything that he just laid out there at all. It's totally
Okay. So
right.
then he goes on to talking about the presidents and the presidential candidates, right? And he says, with Biden, I'm more worried about stagflation with all the government spending, with all the tricks that Yellen's been using to manipulate the yield curve, with the way that the Fed seems to have reignited financial conditions. I think the inflationary outcome could be there, but I also fear regulation and everything else preventing productivity. I mean, I guess you agree with much of what he said there, but do you agree with him that it would continue to be inflationary, or do you think that all the cracks in the infrastructure that you've been talking about, the economic infrastructure, are going to pull things down into disinflation and then maybe even deflation at some point?
Well, I look at inflation in a sort of more nuanced way. My sense, and I got this wrong, which is why corporate profits were so strong. My sense, when we saw the huge increase in inflation through input costs, commodities, and the supply chain issues, was that companies would have a hard time passing all of that increase along. They try to pass some of it along, but I thought they wouldn't be able to pass all of it along. And it would pressure margins because, the inflation in inputs was so substantial. But, to my chagrin or surprise, they were able to pass on a substantial amount of those prices. And the reason why, obviously, was that the consumers they were passing them on to went to their mailbox every month and got a new check from the government. So, and they were doing fine during this whole crazy stimulus period. The fiscal stimulus is no longer taking the form of checks to the mailbox. There's no direct support to consumers, although there is still support coming through state and local stimulus that is eventually trickling out to consumers. So it is helping sustain some of that. But I continue to believe that we're at a point, as we saw with Starbucks, McDonald's, Tyson, that you talked about, where consumers, oh, here she comes.
Here she comes, the superstar.
Here she is, where consumers are now hitting their limits on how much price increases they will take. So what I worry about, I totally share Stan's concern about inflation, but I see that as a margin story because I think the inflation will remain trapped in the pipeline at the input level. And corporations will struggle to pass that along as they have heretofore to consumers. So I do think there will be plenty of inflation impulse, but it will all come out of profit margins.
Okay. I should have noted too that Druckenmiller basically couched all these remarks under the title that he gives the current administration's economic policies an F. Now, just so it doesn't look like we're just beating on the Biden side, on the other side, he didn't have much nice to say about Trump. And he noted that inflation was likely to be even higher under a Trump presidency, particularly if he interferes with the Fed's independence and raises tariffs, both of which he has pledged. So, people are saying it's sort of a preemptive F for Trump as well if he gets in there. Let me ask you this. So I've mentioned this once or twice before in the program. I'd love to get your thoughts. I have this thesis or hypothesis that both presidential candidates have an incentive to let the economy and the markets undergo a correction after the election. So I think it'd be hard for anyone to really doubt that the current administration is not taking extraordinary measures to try to prop things up as much as possible. Right? And you're nodding as I'm saying this. I think they know that, like, look, this is for all the marbles. We're trying to get reelected here. We got to do whatever it takes, kitchen sink, all that. But we can't do this forever. And so if we win in November, then let's let the froth get out of here. Like let's set ourselves up for success at the tail end of this presidency. Yeah, maybe year one's going to be rough as this stuff clears out, but we'll recover in year two. We'll finish strong year three and year four, right? Well, if Trump wins, obviously the Biden administration is going to absolutely stop doing whatever they're doing. So it'll probably start correcting anyways. But then Trump has this golden opportunity to say, "Yeah, let it all crash." Right? I get to blame Biden for that for my first 2 years. It sets the bar a lot lower for me. And then I have a much lower bar to step over when I, finish strong in years three and four and say, wow, look how much I recovered, from my predecessor's mess from here. What do you think about this?
No, I mean, I totally agree with that. I don't know how long, if it were Trump, I think he'd probably love to see the markets and the economy crash in November, December, January, and then, start to put in his policies and watch the economy immediately gain some traction. I think that would be his birthing. But, a bloodletting between November and February would probably be something that he would be fully on board with. Or even, March, April, May, whatever, those first 6 months. So I think that is a very powerful thesis on both sides, absolutely. To your point though, there's what do they say that about the best laid plans of mice and men? The current administration, as you said, is working very hard, obviously, to keep the economy supported, and they very cleverly set forth stimulus that would be hitting net between now and November in anticipation of that. We have this the CHIPS Act, the infrastructure spending, et cetera, all that's still in train and hitting over these next several months. So they do have that going. But the real fly in the ointment for them that they have not been able to control, and I think is really what's impacting consumer sentiment and spending and whatnot, is energy prices. They tried this whole green initiative and it blew up in their faces because, not surprisingly, fossil fuel prices all went up substantially. And now we have this situation in the Middle East that's just exacerbating things on top of what's going on with Russia and the Ukraine and all the geopolitical chess moves around the energy market. So I think that's a real problem for them. And it doesn't look like the efforts that they are, bringing to bear on keeping those prices lower, which I hear are substantial efforts on their part, mostly involving jawboning domestic producers behind the scenes, clearly aren't doing enough because the energy prices really aren't, where are we? $80. We're pretty much stuck at 80. And that's with, you have to imagine, a tremendous amount of pressure being brought to bear to bring that price down. So I'm not sure that they'll, but the long story short, I'm not sure they'll be able to sustain this illusion of strength until November. But
Okay,
I've
so
been anticipating things falling apart a long time ago. So what do I know?
right. So that was one of my questions for you, which is do you think all the efforts to keep things patched together until the election will succeed? Sounds like you're giving it, mixed probability. But let me get your reaction to this idea. I think it's more than an idea, but I'm sure you've seen this article. The video book earlier this week, Stephanie, which will come out the day after you and I are talking here, is with Melody Wright about this topic, which is Meredith Whitney wrote a piece in the Financial Times recently, a couple days ago, basically saying, hey, here's a way to basically inject $1 trillion into consumer household wallets by September and maybe up to $2 trillion by the end of the year. And that's, I guess, Freddie Mac just applied to be able to enter the home equity market. I had a long conversation with Melody. Folks, if you're interested in getting the details of that, I highly recommend you watch it. Melody has a lot of choice words for this, but it smells like one of those. It smells like one of those ideas that an administration facing a tight election would love. Right. Oh my gosh. Even if I can't get the funds deployed in time, and it seems like this would be a relatively swiftly deployed program for as proposed. Now, unclear whether they're really going to get that money in consumers' households before the election, but if they can greenlight it and just say it's coming, obviously the message has a lot of value to them. What do you think? Is this going to be the next part of the stimulus parade here?
It's just so absolutely terrifying. I mean, the whole thought of it just sends chills down my spine and recollections of the housing bubble bust, in 2005, six. Do we not learn from our mistakes? I mean, it would be hard to argue that real estate prices aren't, at extremely extended levels right now, especially relative to home affordability, et cetera. Facilitating people taking cash out of their homes at these prices, just so that they can support spending, just, oh my God, don't even get me started. It's just so terrifying. I can only hope that cooler heads prevail and that they don't go down this avenue, but nothing about the motivations right now suggests that that's really likely. I mean, if they think they can get some money out of it, I'm sure that will be the next rabbit to be pulled out of the hat, with all of the dire consequences that will inevitably be paid down the road.
It's unclear to me whether it would require, I forgot to ask Melody this question, whether this would require congressional approval or not. If it did, I would think it might have a tougher time passing just because the divided Congress, the Republicans would want to thwart anything that they think could help the current administration. But if not, I don't see what would prevent this because it just seems like an idea. My own personal perspective, that's bad enough and self-serving enough for DC to just love.
It's just stupid enough for them to do it. You know, what do they say in Animal House? This situation requires something stupid be done on somebody's part. We're just the guys to do it. You know, you can just see exactly what's going to happen.
All right. Well, look, we'll keep our eye on that, folks, and we'll update on it if and when it becomes a reality. All right. So,
Thanks, Adam. Now I'm not going to sleep tonight thinking about that one. That's
I
just.
know. I mean, and Melody, she's been a mortgage analyst for decades, and she very much has the scars from 2008, and basically, working with many, many mortgage holders who were getting foreclosed on, losing their homes. She just said it was just horrible. That's where you really
Heartbreaking.
see the evils of bad policy. And she's like, we're already seeing stresses in the housing market amongst the lower classes, the lower over leverage classes. And she's like, this would just put absolute rocket fuel on that. But anyways, folks, if that's a topic you want to learn more about, go watch that video with Melody. So back real quick to Druckenmiller's screed. He was railing a lot on the Treasury, which has been responsible for a lot of the deficit spending that's been going on. You have told me before that obviously you're not a huge fan of the Fed. Don't think that they're blameless here by any stretch. It's not just the Treasury's issue here. But it seems like you are actually paying more attention these days to what the Fed plans to do with the balance sheet side of things versus the rate side of things, correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this has all been a function of the untenable fiscal dynamics, my focus on the Fed's balance sheet, because, it's just basic math. You're issuing 2.3 trillion of Treasury securities a year. And we used to have all of that. Well, we weren't issuing 2.3 trillion a year, but let's put a pin in that for now. We used to have all of our Treasury issuance handily absorbed by our foreign creditors, namely foreign central banks, who would recycle their dollars back into our treasury markets, the dollars they received from trading with us, et cetera. This was the vendor financing quid pro quo that Jim Grant so articulately described many, many years ago. And that worked beautifully for everybody involved for a long time. But things have changed, and especially in a world where China is increasingly an engine of global growth. So the need to vendor finance US consumers is diminishing in terms of our share of global trade. But also, we've done some things that have sort of diminished the value of holding your currency reserves in dollars and treasuries in particular, namely by freezing Russia's assets for their invasion of the Ukraine. That was sort of a shot across the bow to any of our, let's say, frenemies out there in the globe, that they might not want to hold their assets in dollars lest the US unilaterally decide to freeze their assets for whatever reason someday. We then doubled down on this weaponization of the dollar in the latest funding bill for aid to the Ukraine and Israel, where they decided that they were going to confiscate those frozen Russian assets to fund
Fund
the
the
war
operation
for the
Ukraine.
Ukraine and
Yeah.
Israel. So it wasn't just that we were freezing them, and then if Russia and the Ukraine came to some peace settlement, we would unfreeze it and they could have their assets back. We now have, usurped all of that. We've confiscated those assets and we're using them, as a means to finance the war in the Ukraine and Israel. So this just doubles down on this weaponization of the dollar. And people are moving. The US dollar share of global forex reserves hit its lowest level in 29 years last quarter. So they're voting with their feet. And right now, people don't pay attention to it or care because they look on their Bloomberg screen and the DXY index is, still up substantially on the year. And everyone's talking about the almighty dollar and look at the yen, which is imploding versus the dollar, so the problem is that if anything, the dollar is too good, but they're missing what's really happening in the real money world, not the paper trading on Wall Street. And the dollar's role in the world is rapidly diminishing, which is a long way of saying, sorry, I got on this tangent, but we no longer have the global central bank support for our treasury market. And so someone's got to fill that void. And the Fed had been filling that void with QE for many years, where it was basically picking up all of the slack, that vendor financing slack was being picked up by the Fed. Then they turned to QT. And I, from the moment they did that, I was like, well, they're not going to be able to do this very long because, our fiscal deficits aren't shrinking. Even if they just stayed stagnant at $1 trillion a year and foreign purchases went down, the Fed needs to fill that void still. Instead, it was compounding the problem by selling 720 billion treasuries, effectively selling, they were adding to that much to supply each year. So for me, it was always a matter of time before they stopped QT. And eventually they're going to have to re-up QE because there's no way to bridge the supply-demand gap in the treasury market other than the Fed stepping in. I mean, the only other way they could do it, and it would take a lot longer to do, would be to legislate that public pensions or something had to hold a X percent of their assets in US treasuries and mandate that, you create a natural buyer in that market. But between now and then, the Fed has to do the job. And that's why, I took a victory lap last week when they announced a much more aggressive taper than people had imagined. And I think it's all on the way to re-expanding the balance sheet soon.
Okay, a couple of things. Some others who I interviewed, suspected something like this was coming too, because you've had shielding the Fed's QT have been, a lot of other parties that have been keeping parties and vehicles that have been keeping net liquidity flows positive, right? And a huge part of that's been the fiscal spending, which we've already talked about. But things like the draining of the reverse repo program, right, which is going to hit zero at some point here relatively quickly. I think part of this is the Fed realizing, hey, once that buffer is gone, the QT that we're doing is really going to start biting in full force, and we need to start moderating that too. But
We also
anyways,
changed the structure of the issuance. 86% of our issuance is T-bills. I mean, who finances $2 trillion deficits with T-bills?
right.
Which are, what are they, 50 basis points higher than you would pay on the long
On
end?
the
I
longer
mean,
end of the curve. Yeah, no, totally, totally. And I just wanted to know, in addition to foreign buyers no longer buying our treasuries, or foreign central banks no longer buying our treasuries, you know what they are buying? And I know you know the answer to this, which is gold, right?
oh,
So
right. Yeah.
just saw a note this morning that in Q1 just came
Yes.
out that World Central Bank, their net gold purchases set a new record. Right. So, that is definitely sending a strong signal in and of itself there, right? That they are actively preferring gold to dollars. And just to, you mentioned pensions, and I say this, I don't even think I say this tongue in cheek, crazily. I think if the government forced pension funds to have to hold a certain amount of US treasuries, I'm going to say that would be a good thing for pension funds, because those hold so much crap right now. You and I have talked a lot in the past. We don't have a lot of time. right now to really get into the whole pension issue. Although I'd love to get your thoughts in general, just sort of on a risk level, where you have it right now, what DEFCON level are you at? But pensions hold so much crap in their balance sheets. This would probably be a step towards better solvency for them if they were forced to do this. I mean, I hate the thought of a government-mandated action like this, but it actually probably might be a net positive for pension funds. What do you think?
Well, I agree that it would be a positive in terms of improving the quality of their asset mix. And if I were, CIO of CalPERS, I'd probably breathe a heavy sigh of relief that I was being forced to do this. The problem is, though, if you have an 8% return target, it's, if you take your actual discounted rate to four, let's say, on a treasury, you mushroom your long-term liability. So it's going to make the shortfall look even bigger, but at least it'll be a more responsible model to eventually get there. I mean, it
Right. Well,
doesn't.
it's assets that aren't going to go to 10 cents or 5 cents on the dollar,
Exactly.
a lot of the crap they hold.
Exactly. So, I mean, I was going to say the point is kind of moot because when those purportedly 8%, private credit vehicles that they have on 10-to-1 leverage blow up, the shortfall is going to explode anyway. So, doing it on an actuarial basis instead of on an actual realized loss basis might be an improvement. But
All right. Well, look, we're getting tight on time. So, like I said, I think we're going to have to push any real deep discussion on pensions into a future conversation. But
that's good. People's eyes are probably glazing over when you say
no,
pension.
no, no. Believe it or not, I get people pinging me relatively frequently about, hey, when are you going to have Stephanie back on to talk about pensions? So I'm just curious, any new news on the pension front since we last talked, or is it just still at the same level of heightened concern?
Well, I mean, every day you get another headline about another pension fund that's decided that they need to increase their allocation to the magical land of alternative assets or private credit, which is, of course, now, the new hot thing that everyone has to be involved in, not to mention leverage. So, it goes from bad to worse, I guess, is basically what I'm seeing.
What percentage are you going to put on a prediction that some material percent of pension funds in the US are going to need to be bailed out by the government in the future?
Oh, wow. What percent odds do I put on that, or what percent of them would need to be bailed
No, no,
out?
no. What percent odds? Like, do you see it as 100% inevitability that this is going to have to happen at some point in the future? Or.
I would say it's pretty close to 100%. I mean, they're already, what, 5 trillion underfunded, and asset prices are pretty much near all-time highs. So, yeah, I think we've got a lot of painful time ahead of us. God forbid there's a reversion to the mean in the stock market or credit. That's going to be ugly.
Well, so this is maybe something we can talk about again in a future discussion, but it's just the coming era of bailouts, as I hate to say it. I mean, this idea we just talked about with Freddie Mac getting into the home equity market. I mean, you can just write the future headline of all the bailouts that are going to come when those loans go default. Same thing in the pension world, as you just mentioned. We're going to have likely the same thing in corporate America, where when the debt issues that you were talking about for them start hitting, we're going to have states, I think, eventually at some point that are going to need bailouts. It's really going to be bailouts galore for the institutions. And of course, who ends up paying the price at the end of the day? It's just the average person. And the pension thing, I fear that a lot, not just because I think it'll be a big tab, but I think that's going to be one that's going to create a lot of social strife because as taxes continue to go up on an increasingly injured populace, you're going to have neighbor versus neighbor, which is, wait a minute, why am I paying taxes for your pension when I'm not getting any help in my retirement?
Yeah, the student loan thing is kind of a window into that. And we haven't really seen as much. I mean, we had that one guy who confronted Elizabeth Warren. I don't know if you saw that clip ever, where she was talking about how we have to forgive these student loans. And, he confronted her after and said, I worked so hard to pay off my kids' college, and now you're going to turn around and bail someone else out. Why did I bust my ass? And that kind of thing. You have to imagine there's a lot of that. And I'll just throw this in there. I know there's not enough time to talk about it, but one thing that I've been thinking a lot about, and it's just so sinister a notion that I'm, I reluctantly force myself to follow it and look for signs of it and see if it's actually getting traction. And that is this idea that this whole student loan gambit has sowed the seeds of a moral hazard on Main Street. We had this Fed put that's created massive moral hazard on Wall Street, where people just take irresponsible risks, including financial institutions and non-bank financial institutions, confident that if anything goes wrong, the Fed will bail them out, come rushing in with the fire hoses. Well, we now have kind of a fiscal put, as it were, for Main Street, possibly. I mean, this is what I'm thinking about and looking for signs of, whereby people look around and maybe they don't have student loans that are being forgiven, but they figure, hey, if they're forgiving these people, all these fancy rich people who got, art history degrees from Berkeley, they're forgiving their debts. Well, why shouldn't they forgive my credit card debt, as I'm trying to put food on the table for my kids and whatnot? And I wonder, to what extent that isn't part of what's driving the huge increase in delinquencies in credit card debt, where people are just running up these balances and have zero intention of ever repaying them because they feel like someday my bailout's going to come too.
Well, and we opened the door. We took the genie out of the bottle with direct fiscal stimulus to households, during the pandemic. So that precedent's been set. So there is an expectation of, look, when I got in trouble last time, you helped me. So why not now? And why not make it bigger, right? So when I interviewed, got so many things that I wish we had more time to talk about. When I interviewed Thomas Hunig, former Kansas City Fed CEO and then former voting member of the FOMC. He was incredibly worried about the precedent that was set by that direct to household stimulus, and said that it's definitely now going to be a part of the playbook going forward, whether we like it or not, whether even policymakers like it or not. Okay, so got so many other things I want to talk about with you on that topic of the moral hazard, and also just sort of the potential enablement of people who overextend themselves to still kind of limp along by support programs like disability right now and how badly that's getting abused, and other types of sort of social support programs. I just recorded an interview that hasn't launched yet with Nicholas Eberhardt, the guy who wrote Men Without Work. And it's the, his research is the growing cohort of Americans. And sadly, it's fast, large and fast growing now, who are literally just taking themselves out of the workforce for no good reason. They're demoralized, or they just don't think that I had a job and actually I wasn't making enough to, it's just better off if I just don't work and I collect on some of these other programs and maybe have some private family that's helping me as well. And they literally are just spending their days basically in front of screens. There's a huge social morass. The analogy I came up with that he really liked was the downstairs, what is it? The downstairs basement's becoming the new opium den, where we're just addicted to our both pain medications and digital devices. And I think it's now like, he said it's like, I think it's 10 million Americans now between the ages of 25 and 54 fit in this class, where they're men and now are increasingly growing cohort of women, unmarried, not engaged in their communities, that are becoming kind of this lost generation here. So all these things are going to come back to bite us. All right. Well, look, in wrapping up here, key question I haven't asked you yet. What's your market outlook for the rest of this year? What do you expect from the market? And what assets do you favor? And perhaps are there any that you particularly disfavor given your outlook?
Well, just broadly, I am really steering away from paper assets in general and hunker down in hard assets. So my portfolio consists of gold primarily, some real estate, and to the extent I have anything else, it would be cash. And I would be dabbling in the long end of the treasury curve because I feel like we're going to hit an inflection in growth. And as I said earlier, I think it's a matter of time before the Fed ends up re-upping QE, in which case, you kind of have quasi yield curve control here. So that would be my sort of positioning. Obviously, I wouldn't touch corporate credit with a 10-foot pole, and I would not draw a distinction between high yield and investment grade because investment grade is basically the same as high yield these days. 50 over, I think it's 55% of what's called investment grade is triple B or lower, which is just, the bottom slug of the investment
Which
grade.
is high yield with lipstick.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's basically one downgrade away from being high yield. So why take the yield hit when you can just buy junk instead and basically own the same thing? So I wouldn't touch any of that. And obviously, I'm not really bullish on the quality of the consumer credit either. And if I had to be, if I were a long only equity manager and I was looking for things to buy, obviously I'd be involved in things that were, like energy, for example, maybe emerging markets to in certain areas. But I'd be very defensive right now, because I think the Fed's kind of in a box. I don't think they can cut rates because of the sticky inflation situation. But on the other hand, there are a lot of signs that the economy is really losing steam, which is why I think they'll end up having to do something through the back door, namely the balance sheet, so they can maintain this illusion of monetary integrity without touching the Fed funds rate, but at the same time manage to stave off any kind of issues in the banking system, which is one thing we haven't talked about yet, but those issues are still very much with us. I'm sure when you talk to Tom Hennig, he probably talked about the banking system and his concerns there, because that was one thing he was talking a lot about with with QT and the impact there. And we've seen, their unrealized losses are still around 500 billion at a time when you're seeing delinquencies go up on obviously commercial real estate and consumer loans, et cetera. And then last week, we got a just staggering decline in deposits. Which, if you start to see a repeat of the regional bank run that we saw last March, that's lights out, obviously, because then they have to realize those unrealized losses on the securities on their books. So I'm watching the deposit situation really closely. It, took a nosedive. And actually, we saw the sharpest contraction in deposits since 9/11 on a 1 week basis, which was shocking to me. And it's not tax related because this data is all seasonally adjusted. And it popped back a little bit last week, but still nowhere near a level anyone would characterize as normal. So I'm keeping a very close eye on that for any signs that, we're going to start to see some more deposit outflow. But it would stand to reason, what happened with SVB is their corporate customers were all these zombie companies. And they were burning through cash so rapidly that it was draining their deposit base. And they just stood by and let the deposit base drain without doing anything about it, grossly mismanaged. But if you're starting to see issues with the consumer where they're drawing down saving to the point that they're starting to deplete their deposits as well, you could see a broader decline in commercial bank deposits that does have bigger, consequence because now they actually have to start selling those underwater securities, and then you got real problems. So just be keeping an eye on
All right.
that.
Yep. Well,
Hey,
okay. If we
a
see more
happy
trouble
note
in
to
the
end on. Just in case you thought the banks were fine.
Well, on a happy note, and real quick, yeah, Tom, Dr. Hennig did, I did ask him because he was a former director of FDIC. And I asked him, one being the best, five being the worst, what's your current assessment of banking system risk? He said four. He said, I'm pretty darn concerned. All right. So a couple of quick closing questions for you. The first, very importantly, for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation with you and would like to follow you and your work, Stephanie, where should they go?
You mean the three people who haven't thrown themselves out the window yet?
I think their heads were in the oven, so they couldn't hear the entire conversation.
Good. Let's hope. So you can find me at macromavens.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at S Palmboy, although I don't tweet a whole lot. I'll go through like periods of frenzied tweeting and then nothing for a couple weeks. So maybe you'll get lucky and catch me in some Twitter frenzy. But those are really the best places. And of course, here, because I'm always happy to get to talk to you, Adam.
Well, Stephanie, we'd love to have you on as often as you can come. And I got to tell you, I mean, the longer it goes without you on this program, the more aggressive the comments that I start getting about, hey, get her back on. All right. Well, look, folks, Stephanie, definitely go check her out at macromavens.com. And Stephanie, when I edit this, I'll put the links up on the screen so folks know where to go. Also, put them in the description below, folks. Stephanie has very kindly agreed to be a contributor to the new MacroPass service for my premium Substack folks. So, premium Substackers, you can rejoice for that. She has also agreed to return as a presenter for Thoughtful Money's fall conference. And the date for that has just been set. So, you guys are the first one to hear about it. It's going to be Saturday, October 19th. Mark your calendars. More details on that will be forthcoming over the next bunch of months. We got plenty of time, but I wanted to make sure that we could secure Stephanie if she was available. Thankfully, she is. And again, for those of you that are really interested in participating, I wanted you to mark that calendar. All right, Steph, it's just always so fun and such a joy. This was no exception. Thanks so much for coming on and for bringing Wilhelmina in too.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you always. And she says hello.
All right, Steph, look forward to seeing you on the channel again soon.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Thoughtful Money, to give their reaction to this great conversation that we just had with Stephanie, as well as give us their update on what's been happening in the markets over the past week. I'm joined as usual by lead partners John Lodra and Mike Preston. Guys, great to see you. Thanks for joining me for yet another week. Let's see. Mike, let's start with you. What were some of your key takeaways from the discussion with Stephanie?
Hey Adam, great to be here. Thanks. Steph had so much facts packed into this, this hour that you and she just talked. I've got a page and a half full of notes, so I'd like to just hit some high points. I learned some things, like I do every time I watch one of your interviews, and this was no exception. Steph talked about her outlook. You asked her what her outlook was on the market. She said the fastest interest rate hikes in history are going to matter eventually. I look back at a chart of the Fed funds rate. It's been over 2 years. In March of 2022, the Fed started to raise rates, and so it's been a long time. The bond market has plummeted since those rate hikes started. In fact, the bond market had a larger peak to trough drawdown than the S&P 500 did during the 2008 bear market. But the stock market hasn't really paid attention. The stock market hasn't cared. Rates are now at 5.25 or so on the 1 year treasury. And we heard for so long that rates are zero. There is no alternative, or TINA. And I see that you're bringing up the Fed funds right there. And so that's a massive, massive jump there in a very short period of time. And there's always, if you look at this chart, the gray area, there's always been some kind of recession after that, right? So it hasn't happened yet. This has been quite a lag. You talk a lot about the lag effect, Adam, and we're seeing it in real time here. So that was like the thrust of the beginning of her talk. There's so much more. I'd like to just hit a couple highlights. I don't know if you had something you wanted to say there.
Nope, just wanted to visualize your comments there about the federal funds rate.
So a few things I've learned here that I didn't know. For instance, the restaurants data in January 2024, the sales in restaurants hit the lowest since COVID. I didn't know that. Stephanie talked a lot about consumers being tapped out and that consumers are running up credit cards just to keep pace. She even speculated that maybe there's some preemptive running up of credit cards and that consumers may think that there's going to be some kind of fiscal bailout, much like there's been a bailout of the student loans. Who knows? I do know that we have had bailout after bailout for a lot of years. And a lot of people are still upset that there's been no consequences for the bailouts that happened during the housing crisis and crash of 2008, 2009. I think it even started before then. Alan Greenspan started to encourage homeowners to take money out on home equity loans, basically the home ATM, if you will. And then the whole thing with cash for clunkers happened a few years after that, then the housing crisis and crash, and it's been bailout after bailout since then. So the corporations have record profit margins. And Steph talked about how corporations can't service debt with slowing profit margins. And she speculated that the profit margins would slow on the input side. She speculated that inflation basically affects raw materials and inputs, labor, more than it affects the output. In other words, they can't raise prices to keep track of inflation. So on the front end, they're getting hurt. And I just have a quick chart I'd like to share here as well. This is a chart of corporate profit margins after tax going back 70 years. So other than the World War II time period, which had around a 9% corporate profit margins have been between 6 and 8% for most of the last 70 years. So this has been a real constant. It wasn't until the late 90s that this started to take off. This whole effect with Alan Greenspan encouraging people to take money out of their houses. And by the way, that exacerbated, in my opinion, the tech bubble, which caused a massive blow off top in the stock market. We had this big crash here during the housing crisis, but that was rescued pretty quickly. Long story short, it seems like we're at this new normal between 9 and 12%. And I guess a message that we want to put out there is that this is not a new normal. The only reason the corporate profit margins are up here at 11 to 12% of GDP is because of deficit spending by the government. Deficit spending that is not sustainable forever. And yet here we are. We have come to believe that the Federal Reserve can bail everything out, and what the Fed can't do with fiscal policy can be done through monetary policy, and the Fed can be done through fiscal policy. There is an end to all of this, and it's gone on a lot longer than we think, but corporate profit margins are going to be under pressure for a lot of different reasons, and that's not a good thing for the stock market, because the only thing that can bail out high valuations is an explosion in growth and or profitability. I just don't see how it happens from here.
Yeah. Hey, Mike, let me just interject real quick. The other thing that was the other big change that I think is responsible for that jump besides deficit spending has been historically low interest rates that also coincided with that same era. And that's one of the reasons why I keep beating this lag effect drum, is because we now no longer have historically low interest rates, and that is going to weigh on those profits as well.
Absolutely. I have a whole lot more that I could recap for Steph's talk. I'm only halfway through my page. Perhaps I should take a pause and let John have a chance. But wonderful talk, and I'll come back with some more stuff a little bit later.
Okay. All right, John, handing the baton to you. Any key reactions you want to build on what Mike said? And also, I believe you've got some charts here to share with us about some of the things that have been happening recently in the economic news.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Adam. Always enjoy Stephanie and Wilhelmina's appearances with you. Always learn a lot, just like Mike says. Hey, Mike, I wonder if you could bring that chart up on the profit margins again, because I wanted to make another point on that. That's a really good chart.
And before you do, John, I just want to reiterate my point I made earlier with Stephanie, which is, profit margins are still elevated, right? And you look at that, and so, you know, I think Stephanie agreed with my question, which is it really does seem that corporate America has sidestepped the inflation that we've experienced since COVID with all the, you know, stimulus and supply chain breakages and all that stuff. And they passed pretty much 100% of it onto the consumer. We can argue whether that's fair or unfair. I tend to think it's much more in the unfair category. But it's hard not to feel a little bit of righteous anger at that.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. So this chart, so I want one thing I'd like to point out on this chart. So Mike rightly points out that profit margins have been unnaturally high for a real long time. What makes this even more kind of insidious, however, is that you not only have record rich margins, but you also have record high valuation multiples. So you have a kind of a double jeopardy, if you will, to steal a line from Jeremy Grantham's recent market commentary. And bear markets usually end, and we're not in a bear market right now, but we think one is certainly in the future, and maybe sooner than we can imagine. Bear markets traditionally end not only when corporate profit margins are narrow and below average, But multiples are also below average. So for example, if you look at this chart in 1982 at that low back there, the Shiller CAPE to cyclically adjusted PE ratio was something like 6 or 7, I think, there. So valuations got tremendously low as well. Right now we're in the mid 30s, I think, on the CAPE. Even in 09, when the market kind of got, you might even say, unnaturally saved by some strokes of a pen by all the rescue programs, the CAPE got down to, I think, 16, 50% below where it is right now. So we have the double doozy of very rich margins, which will mean revert at some point, and we're starting to see some of these cost pressures probably cut into that. But also, we'll probably see a pendulum swing. So going from literally one of the most overvalued valuations of all time to undervalued at some point at the resolution of this market cycle that we think is going to be quite a bit down from here.
So just to restate what you said there, John, make sure everybody follows along. Stock prices are, it's a pretty simple math equation. There's the stock price, and that's made up of the earnings times a multiple, mm-hmm. right? And you're saying that earnings are abnormally high right now because of these heightened profit margins, and the multiple those earnings get tied times by, multiplied by, is also abnormally high by historical standards. Yep. So if the earnings go down, stock prices go down from math. If the multiple goes down, stock prices go down because of the math. But if both of those goes down, stock prices go down much more, again, simply just because of math.
Which is what they always do in bear markets. So we're at double extremes on both margins and valuations at true bear market bottoms. Both of those are extremes at the other end of the spectrum. So you get this massive magnifying repricing, if you will. And that's some great recent commentary by Jeremy Grantham, as I mentioned. And just this week, John Hussman put out his monthly commentary. He touches upon this in at length. So really encourage folks to read that. You know, Adam, I wanted to kind of pick up on Stephanie's rightful observations about the strength of the consumer starting to look like it's running into some air pockets here, and I wanted to kind of share a couple of charts that came across my my feed this morning. So let me just share a screen here. So this is a chart that Lindsay and Saunders from Schwab put out today, and it basically speaks to kind of the declining in consumer confidence, but the absolute skyrocketing of credit card and revolving debt. That is pretty much an anomaly for this history. So that's, and you see here that the debt has actually started to kind of moderate in terms of its year over year growth, even though in some senses there's been some improvement in the consumer sentiment. That speaks to me of a consumer that is running out of runway here. They're running out of capacity to borrow. They're running out of free cash flow to service that debt. And that's really troubling. And then another chart that kind of plays into the same thing. This is kind of a chart of the cumulative pandemic era savings, all the stimulus and payouts and things like that. According to this data here, and Jesse Felder, one of your friends and often guests, does a proper hat tip here to Sober Look, the Daily Shot. Basically those savings have now been exhausted. So I think you and many of your guests, and we would agree, thinks that the can has been kicked quite a bit down the road because of these stimulus programs that were financed with tremendous amounts of deficit spending. We think that's kind of run out of steam and likely to start to show up in kind of the real economy.
All right. So just to talk about that second chart you had there from Jesse Felder. So David Rosenberg made a very similar comment in my interview with him from a few days ago. It sounds like they are ringing the bell and saying the pig is officially out of the python. It has passed through. So there's a lot of deforming and distortion that's been going on because of that massive bolus of stimulus that's gone through. And there still is existing stimulus out there that's still creating some of those deformations and distortions. But in terms of the massive pile of excessive consumer savings that were built up, that pig has now been passed by our python friend.
It appears we're in that phase of the cycle.
Okay. All right. Obviously, John, you take data points like that together. I assume that makes you, concerned about the future of consumer-driven economic growth. in the quarters ahead.
Yeah, we are. And you know, ultimately it comes down to what the stock market and the stock market can be at odds with the economy. It has been in many ways in the last several months. And right now we still see technical, you know, even despite this hugely overvalued backdrop that really has us concerned. That's why we're only about 40% in equities right now, of which we have a big chunk of that hedged. The short-term technical, you know, readings on the markets are still strong. We saw the S&P, you know, for example, took out its 50-day moving average, but it very quickly retested that and seems like it's, you know, kind of holding above there. We look at, you know, kind of the percentage of stocks that are above their own 50-day moving average. That's kind of gone back on a bull signal. So as of right now, we're, you know, kind of patiently and stubbornly more bullish than the fundamentals would warrant, in our opinion. But we think the market is showing a desire to kind of continue to drip higher here. But we'll respond accordingly to our dashboard.
Okay. So I just want to put myself in the mind of the viewer watching this channel, the average viewer. So for the person who says, man, I've just been sitting in dry capital here. I just listened to what Stephanie said. I listened to what you guys just said. I think that the shoes are going to start dropping from here. So whether it's someone who's just been sitting already in you know, a bunch of cash or T-bills or whatever, you know, doing the T-bill and chill thing, or the person who says, hey, I've kind of been managing my own money up until now, but I don't feel confident enough to really navigate to what might be coming. If either of those people were to call you and just say, hey, what can you do to help, you know, create a portfolio strategy for me and maybe manage it for me? Just what would that discussion, how would that discussion go? What are kind of the questions you would ask? What are some of the things that you would look to do with those funds, given the current market conditions?
Yeah, Adam, we would talk to them about their personal situation. A lot of times we talk to people that are just like that. They're in T-bill and chill. By the way, I like that. That I haven't heard you say that before. I like that.
It's a George Gammon line. I can't claim credit for it. I wish I could.
I thought maybe you created it. I like it. But if they're in T-bills and hanging out, for a lot of times we're telling people just to keep doing what they're doing. I mean, it depends upon their goals. It depends upon what they want to do. How much do they want to try to be active in the late phase of this cycle? How much do they want to not worry about it anymore and delegate? You know, for people that want to delegate and they're in line with how we see things, I think it makes a lot of sense to work with us, to hire us and delegate to us, because I believe our process, and I believe in our process, and I believe we can be trusted to guard the downside very well, to not get emotional and get sucked into the bubble in a big way. We certainly are involved in the stock market here, but not that much, about 40%. Exposed at the moment, a little less maybe on a net basis, but that pretty quickly goes down when our hedges kick in on a pretty small immaterial drop in the market. But that's not no risk, right? So there's always some deductible. But for people that want to delegate that, and they believe particularly in gold mining stocks, which we think could take off here and give us some positive lift even at these valuation levels in the broad market, I think it makes sense for them to delegate to us and consider our managed model. But for a lot of other people that don't want to do that, that just want to sit and wait and have the patience to do so, or maybe they have other particular needs, like maybe they've got a business that needs cash, or maybe they simply are waiting for the housing market to correct just a little bit so they can buy a home, because a lot of people feel locked out of this housing market and they're really frustrated. So a lot of times we're talking to people like that. And honestly, it's hard to do wrong by just sitting in treasury bills presently with 5.2% yield on the 1 year, roughly.
Hey, Mike, sorry to interrupt, but if somebody would like to build a T-bill ladder, so not necessarily just buy an ETF for T-bills, but actually own the T-bills themselves, but have it be, you know, a ladder that keeps renewing. Is that something that you guys can help people build?
Absolutely. A bond ladder makes a lot of sense. We've done it for a whole bunch of different people. Some people have needs that are not that great in terms of income, and they don't want to take a risk in this market. And we think there's some opportunity in the bond market, particularly the short end is very good return and almost no risk. You might even say risk-free with U.S. Treasury bills, although we're always careful about that term. But further out on the curve, we think there's some opportunity too. Now, we would take Stephanie's advice, and I wrote down what Stephanie said. Here's what Stephanie likes: hard assets like gold. Can't agree more. Real estate, I think you've got to be careful there. But if you buy correctly and prudently, I think that could still make sense in some areas. She said, dabble in the long bond. Absolutely, we agree. The 10-year treasury is around 4.5 or so. It had gotten as high as 5% or so, dropped to 3.8. It's bounced back to 4.5. We expect the 10-year to go much lower, particularly after we see an asset price drop. I can't agree more with Steph and what she thinks is going to happen with yield curve control. The 10-year probably goes below 3% in the coming years. So I think the long side, the long part of the curve has some merit. She also said energy. We're long-term bulls in energy. We only have a small, you know, small single-digit percentage in energy, but you could consider that on weakness. Emerging markets have the only decent valuations around the world with a Schiller PE in the teens for the most part, as compared to the S&P, which is solidly in the 30s, actually approaching 40. And she also said avoid high yield. We agree. So yeah, sit in treasury bills, consider some of that advice from Steph, delegate to a company like ours if you really want to do that and disengage. You know, make sure that you're hiring somebody that can be trusted not to get emotional and, you know, to get overexposed in a very dangerous market.
All right, John, coming to you, and we're just gonna have to wrap up here soon, just time wise. But we were just on at a special event, online event last night, where you and Mike and some of the other Thoughtful Money advisors were just taking live questions from a private audience. And, you know, generally I sense that there was a lot of unease, a lot of, you know, concern about where things are headed, both economically and where the markets might go, despite all the current exuberance in the financial media. So I thought that was just telling. Curious to see if you sort of picked on the same thing, and what are you hearing from the people that are reaching out to you these days? Like, what's the pulse of the regular investor right now?
Yeah, well, certainly any given day, there are plenty of headlines that can be very concerning, and the logical mind would say these should have an impact on the economy. They should have an impact on the markets. Some of the recent news on employment and stuff like that hasn't been great. You know, GDP numbers have come in soft. You know, but those are just one data points. But you know, it's really important to take a step back and plug into your own life and make sure your position is you know, reflecting what's your life and what your needs are. There is. I mean, look at April was a down month in markets. That was after a pretty uninterrupted move higher from October of last year. So anytime you get a kind of a abrupt change in course, people start to say, "Ooh, well, maybe I should start heading for the exits or this or that." We have seen an uptick of inquisitive concern about some of the things that have happened in markets and the economy. And we're late stage. No matter how you slice it, we already talked about the valuations and the kind of the pig in the python kind of slowly working through. At this stage of market and economic cycles, the most important thing is keeping one's emotional rudder intact and not getting swayed too far in one direction. We think there is great reason to be biased towards being conservative and defensive. If you're going to let your emotions lead you one way, lead it that way. You know, for folks that are overly invested, that have ridden a cycle high here, this is why it's important to talk it through with a friend, an advisor, study up yourself. I mean, it's really important to kind of, you know, survey the landscape and look at many different perspectives of these issues, because it's not all black and white by any stretch.
All right. Well, look, we'll have to wrap it up there. Obviously, folks, as I say every week, I highly recommend that the vast majority of folks watching these videos, unless you already have a good financial advisor who takes into account all the macro issues that Stephanie and I talked about and all the other guests on this channel and I talk about, unless you already have a good one that takes those into account and has put together a great strategy for you, unless you've got a great track record of being a successful DIY investor on your own, highly recommend you work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor. John and Mike just gave you a bunch of additional things to talk about with them when you meet with them. If you'd like, if you don't have a good advisor offhand or don't know of a good one and would like to talk to one of the ones that Thoughtful Money endorses, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. You can schedule an appointment with John and Mike themselves if you want. You know, again, this channel is about giving you information, but not just for information's sake. So you put that information into action in your life to make your wealth work for you. You want to make sure that as many folks as possible are doing that. Also, if you go to thoughtfulmoney.com, that's where you can sign up for our newsletter. You just go to the newsletter link at the top of the site menu there. It's free to sign up for the newsletter. That's where you get all the, you know, related updates on new content and all the goings on at Thoughtful Money. But also, if you upgrade, one of the many benefits you get, in addition to my note summaries of all these interviews, including this one with Stephanie, is where you get the new Macro Pass service. And just mentioned that Stephanie is now going to become a contributor. The day this is airing, the Macro Pass that just launched this week is from Daniel DiMartino Booth. It's a great report. Hopefully you guys who are subscribed are enjoying that. And if you were thinking about subscribing, that's a good one to subscribe for. With that said, boys, it's been a great week. Folks, if you've enjoyed having Stephanie on the program, would like her and Wilhelmina to come back as soon as humanly possible and caninely possible, vote your support for that by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. John and Mike, thanks so much for hanging with me for yet another week.
Thank you, Adam. And we look forward to seeing you next week on video, but also seeing you next week in person.
That's right. No, I'm sorry. I should have asked about this. So give folks the quick plug on the big event that's happening this coming week.
So on May 16th, we'll be in San Juan Capistrano. I'll be from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. local time. And the following day, Friday, May 16th, up in Palo Alto. So it's a West Coast road trip for New Harbor. We've got some special guests, not the least of which is you, Adam. We look forward to that time with you. We've got Jan Van Echt, founder of Van Echt, which is pretty well known in the alternative asset management space, both in gold and in crypto. You'll be interviewing him as well. We look forward to that. And so folks can go to newharborfinancial.com, and there's a tab there that says events. You can take a look at that and click the link to go ahead and register. We've got a lot of interest. A lot of folks are going to be there. We've got a little bit of space left. We hope to see you all there, and we look forward to it.
Great. And I'm super looking forward to it, guys. It's going to be great to spend time with you guys in person. I always look forward to when we get to do that. Can't wait to talk to Jan. But I'm most excited to actually talk to the people that show up. That's where I always get the best ideas on how to evolve the offerings here at Thoughtful Money, because real viewers are telling me what they value and what they'd like to see. So folks, hope you come, especially those that are living in LA and San Francisco, you know, Palo Alto area. Just stop in the car and come drive down. It's going to be a great day. Should be pretty easy for you to get there. And these are always super informative and super fun. All right, guys. Can't wait to see you at the event in just a couple of days. Thanks so much for hanging with me for yet another week here on the channel. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.